Blog Talk Radio.
This is the ACAC Radio Network. Welcome to Ministry Beat, a show designed to highlight the latest happenings here at Allegheny Center Alliance Church with your host, John Stanko. This program will focus on people, events, and current ministries at ACAC, a vibrant urban congregation in the heart of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And now, here is your host, John Stanko.
Well, hello out there in Internet Radio Land. I am coming to you from, I don't know if it's South, it's Midwest, heart of the Midwest. Anyway, I'm in Oklahoma City, and I'm here to follow up on what we talked about last week, and that is to bring you part two of our series, not series, but the forum that we did in February at ACAC on living in a racialized society. And so we had a lot of people listen to last week's, and I apologize. You know, we kind of edited it in-house, and Councilman Daniel Lavelle was speaking about his experience being a Boy Scout leader in the Hill District, and it kind of went off, and we cut it off in mid conversation. So I have to be honest that we didn't go back this week and try and correct that. I'm not going to try and go back and pick up the Councilman Lavelle at the beginning of the conversation. We're just going to kind of pick it up where he left off last week. So excuse me for that, but I think if you listened to last week's, so you shouldn't have any trouble making the segue. Now, trust you were in church this past weekend. Pastor Rock, as usual, had a great sermon and had some good news where Pastor Blaine has been cleared to come back to work part-time, and I saw him there for a couple of services. I was on there Sunday morning on my way here to Oklahoma City. I flew out after I was at church, but then some not-so-good news that one of our young workers in the music worship department had to be let go for conduct inappropriate to somebody in ministry. And so, as Pastor Rock said, you don't need to be in on all the details. I don't need to be in on them. We trust the leadership has covered everything they need to cover. They did in a way that leaves the door open for restoration if that young man so chooses to go in that direction. And so, you know, we this is part of church life, and this is not the first time we've seen it, and it won't be the last time. And so we want to be praying for that department and for that individual, and if we do that, we'll leave the rest unto the Lord. Now, I'm going to be out the next three weekends. I am going to be in this weekend, coming weekend, and if you're listening to it before June 5th and 6th, I'll be in California. And what's there, our only niece is graduating from high school, so we're going to go out for that. Then the following Saturday, the 13th, I get on a bus and I'm going down south retracing the steps of the Civil Rights Tour. And we'll start in North Carolina, and we go to Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi and Tennessee and make a stop in Ohio and then come back to Pittsburgh. So that will actually be 8 days. So I'll be out like a Saturday to the following Sunday. And so that means I'm going to be out three weekends. But we have the sermons online. I always try and listen to them or watch them. And so we'll do radio next Tuesday because I'll be back from California. We probably won't do it the following Tuesday unless I pre-record, and then I'll be back for the last Tuesday in June, and then we can pick it up from there. But right now, without further ado, and I've got some meetings I need to get back to here in Oklahoma City, but I really wanted you to hear the first part of the second part of the show that we started last week. So again, I'm going to bring in part two of Living in a Racialized Society, where we left off last week. Councilman Daniel Lavelle on the Pittsburgh City Council was talking about his work as a Boy Scout leader in the Hill District and then we're going to go on from there. I think it runs about an hour and 10 minutes, and then I'm going to come back, and we'll wrap things up at the end of the broadcast. So I'm just showing somebody here who's looking over my shoulder that all we have to do really is just click on this blue arrow here. I've already uploaded the portion that we're going to have you listen to. So let me go ahead and click, and I'll be back with you in about an hour and 10 minutes. Enjoy it, and we'll talk to you again a little bit later.
He's from the Hill District, but his mind was so open to new experiences and new relationships, and he saw a lot of the young men that he had stereotypes about very differently because he got to interact with them and he got to be around them. And that's sort of everyday work that we have to be engaged in, leaving our communities, seeing that we can sit down across the table and have a conversation and understand that 90% or 99% of what our interests are actually rather aligned.
Amen.
We sent him to West Virginia, huh? I've been there. Never expanded my mind. But anyway. None of the weird people are here, are they? No, don't say. Yeah. Not here. Hey, Mary Esther, you've been very patient and you've listened. You work at the county level, but you're also personally involved. Talk to us about some of your perspective. Comment on what you've heard or something you would want to add to the discussion.
Well, I think there's two aspects, and I think it's something that we've said, and it's not about the differences in the color of our skin. It's about the sameness in the color of our heart. But too often when an issue emerges, we immediately begin to drill down to the differences. If you take even motherhood, immediately people will say, well, that's single mom, that's married mom, that's urban mom, that's suburban mother. They don't just talk about motherhood. They don't talk about the same hopes and dreams that every mother, whether she is a single mom living in a very challenged neighborhood, has the same hopes and dreams as the suburban mother has, whose husband possibly she doesn't even see because he's working 18-hour days. And so we really seem to, every time we have a problem, we don't really approach it from the sameness. All of us do better when we have the sameness. As the councilman just said, it's the sameness of the Boy Scout experience. It brings people together. They dress the same. They do the same experiences. And they thrive with the sameness. We as a society thrive when we focus on the sameness. Excuse me. One challenge, though, when you talked about the last few months, we talked about the legislative experience and the response in America. We have to remember that we in urban centers have an opportunity to really begin to take these experiences and have, at times, not as honest dialogue as we need, but we do have dialogue. And yet we forget that our society is driven by our media markets. There are communities in Pennsylvania today that the only knowledge they have of our issue is what they saw on the TV from Pittsburgh or Philadelphia. Growing up in the coal regions of Pennsylvania, I do not come from a diverse community. I come from a community, there were only two people of color in my whole town. They actually lived a block from my house. The only knowledge the people that I live with, and even at Christmas time went home, turned on TV, the only exposure they have to individuals of color is turning on the Philadelphia news. And no one is taking the leadership in those communities to talk about our sameness, to talk about the issue. So I have a little bit of a different perspective coming from a more rural, more very different life experience than urban America. But we have to begin to understand the power of the media market, that it goes beyond the city of Pittsburgh, because the legislators that you talked of represent those individuals. and the only knowledge base they have is what they see in the media today, because we have not been there. And so I challenge all of us, when we talk about a good missions, we have to be missionaries in communities that do not have any knowledge of our experiences.
Very good. Thank you. Let's stay on the topic of media. We collected questions in advance, and so a number of them addressed media issues. I know, Dr. Emery, you mentioned something, and now Mary Esther has. The media is obviously not going away. We have social media. We have many more platforms. Any of you, and I'll just throw it out open, any of you care to say anything about media issues or perceptions or what we, and you mentioned when we see something, Emma, to, you know, get on it and let someone know it's unacceptable or we're challenging their perspective. But let's just put media out there. The questions have been, you know, what can we do? And the media does very much. I mean, the Monroeville incident last night was viral, you know, within minutes. Our daughter in Washington, D.C., you know, saw it within minutes of it happening and is calling home. Anyone care to comment on the challenges or the opportunities that we face in this viral world where things are instantly available?
Well, the media is very, very important to my work every day, and I think is important to all of you. But I think with the speed of change in communications, you probably all appreciate that the media is going through a dramatic sea change right now. And just like in 1960 during the presidential election, we talked about, we had the advent of the television news cycle. We now have the snap news cycle of the internet, and newspapers are struggling because subscriptions are down. The news is more available on the internet. Social media communication has actually challenged the major networks, and as a result, I think the news has become to be entertainment. And so what you commonly would refer to as a deep drill down of a sensitive issue, you have to search for, because the more conventional platforms to receive this are in a commercial battle for their very existence. And so often they have to report things that will capture immediate snap attention of those of you who are the consumers. And this presents challenges for the media, but dramatic challenges for all of us. When we talk about racism in a racialized society, you know, we have two really big challenges to address. One is the overt racism that might be exhibited by Bull Connor, if you've just seen the Selma movie, and that still exists. And if you doubt it, I created a dedicated civil rights group here 4 years ago, and I've brought in 7 cross-burning cases on behalf of all of you here in Western Pennsylvania. So if anyone tells you that direct overt racism is gone, forget about it, we don't have to worry about that, that's not true. But the more pernicious problem, I think, is unconscious bias. And I saw a presentation by a great professor from Stanford on the day I think she was announced as the winner of the MacArthur Prize. And it was presented to us at the Department of Justice. I'm trying to bring it to Pittsburgh, about how we all have unconscious bias and how we see this bias largely because of the experience Mary Esther talked about, and this bias operates on us. But just consider this illustration for sake of discussion, and I guarantee this has happened to all of you many times. If someone said that they had attended this forum and that they mentioned that they saw me, would they describe me as white? But how often do people describe someone they meet in the course of a day and say, you know, an electrician came over to fix the house, he was black. Why is that? What does that have to do with anything? They don't describe me as having beautiful flowing hair. Which I did at one time. They don't describe people by their eye color, their hair color, but still, today in 2015, And sometimes it happens in the most, you know, heartbreaking ways, that someone makes a wonderful presentation in the meeting and then they drop as a footnote and he was black, as if that's a surprise. That's the unconscious bias that operates. And the presentation I saw in Washington was so moving because white people have unconscious bias towards black males, but so do black people. Black people fear black males as well. And the presenter was African American, and she told vignettes through her presentation, and one brought us all to tears. And she told the story, I hope she doesn't mind me repeating it in a public forum, but she told the story that her husband's 5'9" and combs his hair back short like I do, and she was on the plane with her two sons, one was 3 and one was 5, and a 6'2" African American male got on the plane with dreads. And one of her sons said to her, "There's Daddy." She said, "That's not Daddy. He's taller than Daddy, and Daddy doesn't have hair like that." And her son said, "Well, that's right. Boy, I sure hope he doesn't rob the plane." And at Homewood Children's Village, there's a story very similar when they gathered the young African-American children to get together to proceed from one event to another event in the course of their day. One of the 4-year-olds said, "Are we being taken to jail?" Now, that should concern all of us. That should concern all of us. And that's the role of the media, which I don't say to criticize the media, but if you just spend a day, if you have a mental health day and you do nothing but sit in your pajamas and watch TV, take a notebook and count the number of times you see events on television over a course of a random day, which would leave you with the impression that if you were black, you should have self-esteem problem, because there's not fairness in just the general menu of what we watch, and that presents problems for us.
Mm-hmm. I'll make a couple of comments. I was challenged in November when I went out to see my daughter, and I'll share with you, she passed the bar in Texas. So I had to be there for the swearing-in ceremony.
Sure.
While I was there, since it was close to Christmas, I asked my grandchildren what did they want for Christmas. Now, I have 2 granddaughters. One is 4 and one is 3. And they did not know that I had already ordered them an African-American doll. So I said, "What do you want Nana to get you for Christmas?" And they said, "We want, what's the name of the Frozen character? Elsa. We want Elsa." And I said, "You really?" "Yeah, Nana. Elsa has the long hair." "No, no, 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 no." I kept thinking, they don't know. Nana isn't going to buy them Elsa. Now, the aunt bought them Elsa, but Nana didn't. And I'm going to be frank with you. I will not buy my granddaughter's white dolls, because of self-esteem issues.
Right.
And you know about the Clark studies, when the African-American girls always picked the white doll because they did not see themselves in the same image. White means what? Pure, clean, innocent. What does black mean? Tell me. Dirty. Bad. What are some other characteristics? What was it?
Scary.
Shady. Exactly. Why is that? How is that being fed? And I should say, the Clark study was repeated in the 1990s. Were the results the same? Yes, they were. So that says that they are not being exposed enough to what is positive about themselves. The whole issue around hair today. Now, we can
not
go there.
Though. Not yours, though.
We won't go there for the attorney.
Are you making fun of me? I could grow it out at any moment. This is just so I can get out of the house fast.
Okay. But
I want to be Sheldon.
But there is a real concern around whether you should wear your dress, whether you should allow your hair to be natural and full, or you should process it. Why is it we don't see, some people don't see the natural look as being acceptable? Okay? And we've even had situations where employees have been, you know, challenged because of the choices they made around the way they look. I'm just sharing that to say there are still things we have to deal with in terms of what is acceptable based on who we are, the color we are, and some of the natural characteristics that we have. So we really have to work on the family that so many of our children come from. It doesn't matter that they are in single-headed households, because there are enough individuals in the community, black or white, yellow, red, it doesn't matter. There are enough individuals to be role models for our children. And we have to step up. And I know there are a lot of organizations here in the Pittsburgh area even who are mentoring individuals. There is an article in the Courier this week about, is the Pittsburgh promise really the promise for African-American children? And there are groups of males, African-American males, who are trying to make sure that African-American students do qualify for the Pittsburgh promise. And they can do it. I'm just going to share one other example with you. I'm working with a group through the Hill House Association. We're going to take 10 students from the Hill to Ireland in July. And we're very, very pleased that we are in the fundraising mode and people are supporting this. I mean, I've had people to just walk up to me at the Y and say, I know about your project, so here's $10, here's another $5. All of that helps because we don't want the kids to pay anything. So why is it we're doing this? We're doing this because for 4 years, we've had students from Ireland to come to the Hill District, and we've hosted them, and they've had a wonderful experience. They go back to Ireland, they write us and tell us that the situations they've experienced in Ireland because of the religious tensions are so similar to the racial tensions that exist here in the United States. So we are going to reciprocate so our students can experience the religious tensions that they, that the Irish students have experienced when they go to Ireland. But when we interview students in the Hill for the positions, all of them had to apply. If I looked at the resumes of at least five of those students, I would have rejected them right off the bat. And that's sad. That's really sad. Because of the appearance of the application, because of the writing that was used in the application. But I want you to know, when they came for the interview, all 10 of them were stellar. That written document did not represent those students. So what did it say to me? There's a gap in the educational system. So how can we correct that gap? It's got to be with the family and the community. We have to be there. We have to support our young people. I could not believe two of them even wore ties to the interview. I was so impressed. And when they sat down and you asked them questions, the leadership they exhibited, the language that they used, the examples they gave us of Ireland. Now, some of the examples, we're not going to those places in Ireland, but at least they had taken the time to go to the internet and find out some information. Now, isn't that motivation? Isn't that an indication that these students are talented? So why is it when I looked at those applications again, the grades were not what I would have wanted to see from that interview? And why is it the writing was not as well as it could have been based on the way they presented themselves in the interview? So that says to me, we've got a lot of work to do. We've got a lot of work to do. I believe we've got to start with the family, and we've got to start with the community. So the media sometimes does not present that side of our African-American children who are talented, who are intelligent, who want the very best they can acquire if given the opportunity. So we have to make sure that they have opportunities so they can do some of the things that they see. Because, see, our students are in a conflict theoretical situation. They see, but it's not me. So why is it not me when I can see, you know, white students doing all kinds of things? Let me tell you, one of our candidates plays hockey, and he's really good at it. So how many African Americans do you see playing hockey? Okay, exposure, opportunity. Those are the kinds of things, and it doesn't matter whether you come from a single-parent household, you come from a poor household, you've got other institutions, mm-hmm. the churches, community groups, organizations who are there to build a safety net for some of our students. So we have to make sure that we give them hope. One of the things that Lebo did in his book, Tally's Corner, which is a classic, he studied men who stood on the corner all the time. And for the most part, they talked about these men just not caring and coming to the corner every day. And I see men at McDonald's sometimes every morning for their coffee, sitting around talking. And that's their camaraderie. But these men stood on the corner every day, didn't work. And when he explored why they were on the corner, you know what they said? Because I went for a job, and it's the way I was treated in the interview. And then I was rejected. I really want to work, but I haven't had the opportunity. So his study indicated that you can't allow the negative situations to keep you in a suppressed position, but you have to always motivate individuals to do better. And if mm-hmm. given an opportunity, a lot of people will.
Amen. Emma, do you have change for 20? Because I heard what you were saying. You were receiving contributions, so there's something for the. No, keep the whole 20. Keep the whole 20. And I just hope the scout in the hill doesn't hear that everybody else is going to Ireland, and he got to go to West Virginia.
Yeah.
But
thank you.
There are things we can all do to encourage people along the way. We could go on with the media, and I think we'll open it up to the floor in about 10 minutes, if that's okay, Pastor Sheldon. But you helped us segue too. We've had a lot of questions about young people, and we've addressed it, with scouts and with what you're saying here. What proactively can we do? In one sense, some of the questions that said are young people are in some ways less color conscious than their parents and grandparents are. So how can we capture that at the same time they are victims of the society and the issues that we've been addressing tonight? Any comments, any thoughts on the next generation? One thing I think we're hearing too is that while the established media have their issues and bias, there's never been a better day to establish our own media and to be able to tell our own stories and not rely on someone else to do that. So I guess I'm mixing all those things in, but would anybody have any thoughts? I know we've housed Urban Impact Foundation here, and I've thought about many of the things that they do in light of what we're talking about today, but what can we do for our young people that we haven't already talked about? And how can we harvest where they already are and that they're a little further down the road than where maybe their parents and grandparents are? Any thoughts?
I would offer this. I did a forum at Brooklyn for the Homeless Children's Education Fund, which is still available if you Google it because it was televised. But they had up here the community where the educational performance was poor, and over there they had the community where the crime existed, and they were the same map.
Mm-hmm.
So for purposes of my job, I can predict, based upon lack of education, where the crime will go. We base decisions on prison construction based upon test scores in third grade. So if there's one thing we could do for the young people that everyone could pitch in on, it would be to get people to school and get people educated and give all the support we need, all the scaffolding around them that is necessary to ensure. We're currently studying absenteeism. We didn't fully understand the nuanced impact of absenteeism. And we know that even if you are struggling in math, it could be because you didn't get the proper training in English when you were younger. But if we could get all of our resources and all of the oars in the boat, the community boat, rowing in the same direction, the one thing I would advocate for is a total and complete commitment to education, particularly kids of disadvantage.
If I could just make one point around that, because I totally agree with him. But in addressing education, what I've come to learn is that you also have to address the family. There's a church in the Hill District, Macedonia Baptist Church, that has a program around absenteeism, truancy, and the like. And part of what they found was there are some kids that are not showing up to school because they got to take care of their younger children, because mom is at work for two or three jobs, or grandma didn't get up in the morning and make breakfast, so they were hungry. And these issues are real. So in doing so, we need to absolutely invest in education, because it is the gateway to a better tomorrow. But we also have to look at what's happening at home. So many of these young children, when they return home, are not getting the follow-up support necessary. I don't know who did the study, Doctor, you might know, but there was a study that looked at some children, what happens over the summer when they return home, and the children that have strong family units, when they come back to school, they've maintained what they learned, and in fact, they've advanced some because they've had some summer activity. So many of our children in poor, struggling neighborhoods, when they return, they've regressed because they didn't have that support that they needed. Lastly, I would say, and this is something very simple, but something I am very intentional with my children are 4 and 2, is read to them. Prior to coming back to Pittsburgh, I was living in Akron, Ohio, and working at a correctional facility. And your correlation of education, 80% of the gentlemen there, and this was a facility that this was their last chance to try to make it in society. There was sort of a four-step program you had to go through to make it out. What I discovered was 85% of everyone in that facility from 18 to 75 did not have a high school education, did not have their high school diploma. And what was even more startling was in that facility, we had punishment where if whatever rule you broke, you may then have to be in charge of cleaning the bathrooms that day or cleaning up the mess hall or whatever it may be. When I got involved there, there were no books in this facility. And the punishment that I made all the men around me do is when they cursed around me, when they broke any of the rules, I made them write an essay. And it quickly spread throughout the facility to not mess around with Mr. Lavelle, because he's going to make you write. Like, the importance of reading and opening up a child's mind and giving them that basic fundamental skill set that they can build on is so very, very critical. You should also know that in some of our Pittsburgh public schools, there was one here in Manchester a few years back. We actually had volunteers had to come in and build the school library. They did not have a functioning school library in their elementary school. Some of our kids are not allowed to take books home from their middle school and high school. A little thing that we can all do is provide a book for a child, whether it be a fictional book, a historical book, a textbook, and give them that very fundamental skill set that they can build on.
Let me have one quick thing on that.
Please.
To those of you in the audience tonight, if you wanted to do one thing for your community and yourself, it's read to children. A lot of the work people like me do, you never hear about, but one of the things I do that I enjoy the most is reading to young children. And many people in our office do it quietly in Homewood and other distressed communities over the course of the week. If you're having a bad day, the best prescription to turn that around would be read to a class of 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old children in one of our schools. Read The Giving Tree to them, my favorite book of all time, which I read to them. We need people to read to the kids. If this army that's here tonight, as just an example, were to dedicate itself to doing that starting tomorrow, we could make an immediate positive change across all lines.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If John. I can just add, take your children to the library mm-hmm. and have them to check out books. That
John,
would help.
John, could
you.
I just add?
Oh, please. Yeah, I would just, to you next.
Oh, mm-hmm. No. I would just add, I think sometimes I hear people, especially in the city, talk about the Pittsburgh public schools and their problems, their deficiencies, whether real or perceived. And sometimes I'm afraid people can just sit back and say they need to fix their system. They need to fix their delivery system. Look how much money they get through taxes, and they keep increasing our school tax, yada, yada, yada. And we put the onus there. I know we have many public school teachers in our congregation. Many of them are greatly discouraged because they are battling, they're fighting an uphill fight. I mean, it's just overwhelming what they have to deal with. But I simply want to remind us, rather than waiting for the school system to fix itself, we can do so much to augment that school system on the individual and private level. I mean, here at ACAC, for example, between us and Urban Impact, close to 500 children spend their summer in summer day camps. Staying out of trouble, getting reading instruction, getting prepped for the next school year. Every weekday after school being done across the street. Through Urban Impact, the children who go through their entire mentoring program, 98%+ either go to the military or go on to trade school or go on to get a job. All of this is happening outside of the public school system. And I think sometimes we just keep saying they need to fix themselves, they don't use the money wisely, whatever, whatever, whatever. But we can do so much, and as David had said, even just reading with a child, we can do so much as individuals, so much on a voluntary basis with virtually no cost to change so many of these things and change the destinies of these children. Yeah. Amen. This is not to... This is not to bang the ACAC drum, but it's mostly family here. But I've traveled quite a bit, visited a lot of churches. I don't know many who have 5 full-time staff and children and 5 full-time staff and youth. And that's not to pat ourselves on the back, no applause. But I really was coming to you next because while we're working again on the macro, we've got to be scoutmasters. You know, we've got to read the children. And there are things that we do, and so the dollars that we donate, are imperfectly at times, but are being invested in things that can make a difference day in and day out. And years ago, my son was running. He was young, and he was running on a softball field. We were softball practice, adult, and I thought I should have him get off the field. And I thought I'll let him go. And 10 minutes later, he got hit in the mouth. And got 8 stitches in his lip. And I felt like the Lord spoke to me and said, that's how leadership is. You know, I don't understand. Because if I would have pulled him off the field, that ball would have rolled to the fence, and he would have never known what he missed. And what you do as a volunteer, you'll never know what you prevented from happening. That's our faith aspect of what we do. That somehow the idea in that book impacted somebody's life, and it came back to them at another time. When they were considering a wrong choice, they were able to make a right choice. And so I think we're going back to what Dr. Emma said. She challenged us to be activists, but it's not always on the macro level.
No.
It's on the micro level. Mary Esther, anything to add?
I think just one other strategy is the summer food program is a very good example of doing an individual, how you can help our community. We know that our children, once they leave the school premises, some of our children are extremely challenged. And not having proper nutrition means that they don't get the proper brain growth that they need.
Mm-hmm.
And so by the time they come back to us in September, we've lost not only 3 months of learning, but we've lost 3 months of very good nutrition.
Mm.
And so if you know of communities that do not have a summer food site, I would encourage you to go back to your municipalities and request that.
Yeah, and it takes resources, and
mm-hmm.
the government can't
mm-hmm.
do all
yes.
of that. There are individuals like all of us that have to do it. Well, Pastor Sheldon, you want to open it up? What we'd like to do is invite your questions. Now, I'm going to hold you on a pretty tight leash. What ye do, do quickly, as Jesus said to Judas. And all right. Wasn't the best, but you get the point.
Yes.
And now, this is not a time to preach. We want to hear from those who are our guests, who obviously we have seen tonight have something to say. So if you want to address a question, and we have a microphone right here, if you want to step out and approach the mic, and if you want to ask a question to a specific panel member, please feel free to do so. If you want to throw it out in general, please feel free to do so, but we don't want to just be talking up here. We do want to, and this is our second effort at doing this, right,
mm-hmm.
Pastor Sheldon, Pastor Rock? We're going to do more of these, so we're going to learn the format of how we can do these more effectively. So Pastor Marv, you look like you're moving to, thank you, Jesus, somebody came. And
yeah, but he's a preacher, so
yeah.
Hold that tight leash.
Yeah, it's going to be real quick.
Do it just like
quick.
I wrote it, please.
This is for Councilman Lavelle. The question of gentrification, you say redistribution is a problem, and I've seen it happen a lot in Pittsburgh where we're taking the things that are needed and we're taking them even more from the poor to gentrify certain areas that then raise the cost of living, and then
right.
we're dispelling certain impoverished people to more impoverished areas. How can we stymie that? Is there a way that we can block that? Or if there is a group that wants to move into a certain area, how can we make sure the cost of living stays where it's affordable for those that are already there?
Excuse me. Before you answer, if you have another question, go ahead and you can just line up at the microphone so we can be efficient with our time. I'm sorry, Councilman, didn't mean to.
Thank you, and I know time is short, so that's a multi-layered question.
Well, we're going to go till about 10 after.
Okay.
Start a little bit late,
yeah.
So my plan is to go till about 8:10.
Multi-layered question. One, I would say, if that's a concern of yours or anyone else's, please see me afterward. But recently, as part of that conversation, I introduced into council an affordable housing task force to look at the needs of the city citywide. We can look no further than Central Northside here on the north side to see what the appreciation of home value has done and some tension that has caused within the neighborhood relative to gentrification, displacement, and other concerns. So that's one of the ways I'm looking at it. Through this task force, I hope to be able to examine other policies from other cities. New York City has adopted sort of a citywide. There's rental control programs. There are just inclusionary zoning measures. So there's some legislative ways we may be able to adjust, deal with this. The other reality to all of this is that we have to address the economics of the community. What I've said from day one, when I began the fight to tear down the old Civic Arena and to begin rebuilding the Lower Hill District, I could care less about the bricks and mortar. My goal was through that development to change the economic reality of the neighborhood, meaning the business opportunities, every job opportunity, the contracting opportunities. What is every dollar that's going to come through this billion-dollar development, and how is it going to flow back into our neighborhood so that at the end of the day, the people who may be displaced in 15 years can get jobs, can have real wages, and can afford to stay there? Because that's the ideal, that no matter where you live, you should be able to afford that. So we have to raise the economics, and there's other ways of which I'm attempting to do that as well through local hiring legislation that would say when we do these major developments, that the people people living there should have the first opportunity to actually work there and be a part of that development. So there are ways to do it, but it's a multi-layered question, and that literally could take like an hour to go.
Yeah. Thank you for not taking an hour. So, yeah. So, thank you. Bob?
Okay. My name's Bob LaFon. I've been a member here for 21 years. And along the way, I've been able to volunteer with the youth group here at ACAC. I've been one of the original founding volunteers for Urban Impact Foundation. I'm currently on the advisory board of an organization, a nonprofit ministry called Young Lives Three Rivers, that ministers to teen single mothers, as well as I've done fundraising activities for the Homeless Children's Education Fund. And the one thing that stood out to me tonight, and I want to applaud all of you for coming because your contributions are invaluable, this conversation is invaluable, and I thank God we're going to get to do this again. And a lot of great points came out. One thing that sticks in my mind, though, James chapter 5 says that faith without works is dead. So we have got to take the next steps, and we have to put our feet to our faith, and we have to do something besides talk. So I'd like to challenge you folks who are not part of ACAC to do something here that may be a little bit out of the norm. Take a look at not just ACAC successes, but Urban Impact Foundation. If you call what Pastor Rock said, who's been on the board and was involved in the inception of the organization, 98%, I'll call it graduation rate for a lack of better term, of young people who are joining the military, getting jobs, going to trade school, or going to college. Where do we see that in government or civic society? I'm 52 years old. I can tell you for a fact it doesn't exist. Not here, not anywhere else. Throwing money at the problem isn't part of the solution. So I'd like to challenge anybody who's involved in any form of government, academia, media, take a look at the successes that God is putting here through ACAC and Urban Impact Foundation. You may learn something about how we can be more productive as a culture and a society at solving some of these problems, because money isn't the solution. Feet on the ground, people being involved, that's where it's going to make the biggest difference. Thank you.
Duly noted. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Bruce Grover, and I'm also a member here. And again, I want to thank you guys for showing up, too. Just a couple of comments, then just a question. Number one, thank you, Mr. Hickton, for just bringing up a point about how young African-Americans see other males. I'll give you a quick example from my son. My son's an avid reader. In fact, he almost broke me because he didn't want to go to the library. He wanted his own books.
No.
And he was an avid reader, and anybody here who knows him knows he's an outstanding student. But one of the things that he had faced when he would read in the summer was he would get teased. He would actually get teased and be called a white boy. Mm-hmm. And why would he, you know, why are you reading? Why are you trying to be white? I mean, he went through school practically a 4.0 student. So we had to deal with that issue. That's an issue on top of the many layers that we have in this racialized society. Those are those self-esteem images that we as parents, and particularly in African American men, have to deal with. The other thing that I have to say is, you know, I'm kind of have a two-edged sword about the media. I know people have their own concept of the media. However, without the media exposing some of those things, as you said, Mr. Lavelle, these things were happening 30 years ago. The only thing that wasn't available, you know, was a cell phone and a TV camera. So the media, however they portray it, doesn't negate the fact that these injustices occur.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just
very good. Thank you. Thank you, Bruce. Hi there. What is your name?
Hi, my name is Ginger Underwood. I'm from Marshall, Shetland, and I want to thank everyone for coming and participating. I want to make several comments. First of all, I think that a lot of the tension that comes around from both sides is around economics. I think that for Caucasians, they believe that Black people, all Black people are just takers. And so the one person that I know of who addresses this appropriately is Tim Wise. So I don't know if anybody knows about Tim Wise. I'm sure some people do. But I think on a citywide level, this is somebody that the city needs to bring in or some groups can get together and bring him in so that, like, some of the myths can be dispelled. You know, it's one thing when you start on third base. It's another thing when you can't even get out the dugout. So we need to, like, talk about the playing field, you know, and how white people have benefited from government programs and so on and so forth. That's one comment.
Okay, and I'm looking up Tim Wise.
Okay.
He's an anti-racist essayist, author, and educator.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
okay,
thank
and
you.
I want to say one other thing.
One
I'm
other
involved
thing.
With the Buell Foundation,
mm-hmm.
and I've been on the, I was part of the original census team, so I've went around in the different neighborhoods. And I think Daniel alluded to it that, you know, we rank, what, 40 or somewhere around there. And if you read the report that Pitt just put out, the disparity. I mean, we have world-class hospitals, and we still lead in infant mortality. It's unacceptable. It's unacceptable. And so,
Ginger, you have a question? Did you want to ask?
No,
okay.
I just want to say, like he said, we can't just keep talking about it.
Okay.
You know, it's time to do something about
Very
it.
Very good. Thank you, dear. Thank you. Appreciate it. Yep. Hi, Fred. Fred, you got a question?
Yes, I do.
All
My
right.
name is Fred Smith, and I want to thank everybody for being here. My question, well, I want to make a statement.
How did I know a statement was in there? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, all right. Go ahead. You got to end it with a question. You promise?
I'll
the Lord
try.
Is watching now. I mean, this is a house of God, so. All right, go ahead.
Well, we talked about the educational system. And one of the things that, you know, that I feel that is missing, because, you know, I did ask my children that they want to come. But when you talk about race, they don't want to talk about race. Because when we talk about race, it's all associated with slavery. There's no idea of the benefits because they're not being educated in school about black history. Because, you know, somebody told me at one point that if they was to educate these kids about black history in the public school, then the kids would be mad and there would be a problem there. So I don't know if that's the reason why it's not being done, because the opposite can happen as well. They can realize of the contributions that was made to this society or this country, that they can identify with these people who made these contributions and be okay. able to find a reason why education is important to them.
Okay, there's a question yeah. in here somewhere.
Right.
Right? Okay.
So I just want to know, I mean, what can be done, you know? I mean, do we need to do something within the community? Because it's not being taught nowhere. Black history is about to be history, period, you know, and it's going to be no longer history. It's going out with sewing and with cooking. All that is soon to be history. Yeah, so
yeah, all right.
I just want to know.
I'm going to ask Dr. Hemmer.
Anybody
can you,
well,
can you address
any insight
well,
on that?
Well, I'm glad as he's speaking as a parent, because parents can make a difference here in terms of what the curriculum exists of in a school system. I do know the Pittsburgh Public School does include some social studies that, you know, touches on aspects of black history. But the problem is that a lot of books have not been inclusive of that history. Now, here again, it's important for us to do what we need to do as parents in the home. So we can help that history by buying the books, you know, taking them to see Selma if they are old enough, you know, talking to them about the history that did exist. So I don't want to put it all on the educational system, even though it should be inclusive, but there are some things we can do, too, to make sure that they understand the history.
Yeah, and I don't think we should burden just the black community with doing that. I think we as the white community need to do that. At Geneva College, I teach African-American literature and black theology, and I'm as ignorant as a clam, but they are great classes because we're learning together. Mm-hmm. Don't delegate that. That's mm-hmm. all of our responsibility. One of the phrases we've heard tonight is intentionality, mm-hmm. and if we're going to see changes, we've got to do intentional things. So we've got to step out of our comfort zone. And so within your own, your blogging or your social media or your families, do what you can to expand the awareness of those that God has given you charge over. And it may not be macro, it may not be thousands, it may be two or three, but it can make a difference. Would you agree?
Absolutely.
You're okay. So very good. Rose, hi there. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm Rosemary Anderson. And for 8 years, I've been mailing books to prisoners all over the United States. Mm-hmm. And we've had tens of thousands of letters. They ask for black studies. We always have it. We always send it. And all sorts of other educational books. Many of them have a burning desire to better themselves, maybe for the first time. And they know when they get out they need job skills. They want to learn how to start businesses. It's a wonderful program, but we're usually lacking postage money, and we've been homeless several times. And this last year, I tried to find us a place in a church, and I couldn't find any church that would take us in, even when they had a lot of space. And right now, we're in a building with no heat and no water. But we're going to be sending books out anyway, more so when it's warmer than right now. And some people say that they don't want to donate to send books to prisoners. They say they want the prisoners to suffer, that they deserve to be there. But that's not true. When 10% are innocent or wrongfully convicted, and many of the guilty ones are sorry for what they did, and anyone who wants to read should have the books and the dictionaries, which is our most popular request. Books to Prisoners programs really need help.
Okay. Question? Or is that an appeal?
That's an appeal, okay. And there's a question in my mind of how to get help from society.
Let me say,
church.
Please. I want to salute you for the work you're doing and say that... by any definition, it's the Lord's work, but it's also an important policy initiative of President Obama, Attorney General Holder, and I've been very vocal on it here. In our business, we call that reentry work. I teach classes. We don't have the resources we need. But part of the discussion has to evolve to this. If we're serious about having safer communities going forward, we together, all of us, have to make the case about the importance of reentry. And as Western Pennsylvanians, you need to know that some of the best work in the country is being done right here. We have the Allegheny County Jail Collaborative, where the Department of Justice has invested millions to change the metrics of how a person reenters society. It used to be that when a person went into prison, they might go in the summer with a t-shirt and swim trunks on, and they would be released in the middle of the night, in sub-zero weather, mm-hmm. with no bus pass, no training, no way to survive. Why were we surprised that we had such a large recidivism rate? People are going back to prison within 3 years at the rate of 85%. Through this program, which has just been studied, and efforts of good people like you, we know that once a person pays their debt to society, we need to invest in them, and that investment can pay off. And that's the best way we can get crime to be reduced. So congratulations.
Yeah, thank you, Rose. Thank you. We're going to try and end on time, and so those who are in line, we're going to limit the remaining questions to those who are already in line, and with the promise that, do you think we should do this again? You think we should have you? Yeah, I think so, too. So, Teresa, go ahead, dear.
I want to direct one of my questions to Councilman Lavelle. They did a study on
low-income
apartments on Bentley Drive.
Get a little closer to the mic.
And they were stating that, it's been there like 45 years, and they really haven't seen any turnaround in growth. But there are people who are still in that area holding out hope for things to turn around. Basically, the publicity that has come forth is a high amount of crime and murders. but there are still a lot of people doing good things with little amount of money and funds and means and donations.
Okay. Question?
What can we see the city coming about doing? Because when it happened, something similar in Larimore, it took like 10 years before they finally made a groundbreaking and decided they would bring apartments and other businesses back into that area. People wrote letters for 10 years trying to get funding.
Sure.
What do you see the turnaround coming about and when there?
I don't know exactly, to be honest. Some of it is funding that comes from the federal government down to the city for rebuilding that neighborhood. As you probably are well aware, we're currently rebuilding Addison Terrace,
yes.
Which was similar to Bentley Drive. We've already completed phase one. We're working on phase two now. Over the next 2 years, we'll finish up phase three and four, after which we would hope to be able to come over to Bedford Avenue and begin working there. But much of it is also going to be contingent on getting the millions of dollars necessary to rebuild. But that was initially part of the Hope 6 program, and the entire stretch of Bedford was supposed to have been done, but they ran out of money, which is why they stopped halfway through. So it's a matter of us finding the funding, and I can't make a promise on when that'll happen. But we're actively trying to redo all of that.
But do you believe, like, within the political, social part of it, that things will turn around, they will get people in who care about education, who care about their kids being fed well, have proper housing safety, all these issues that regular Americans take for granted because they have police protection?
I do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
yes,
you.
Ma'am.
Good to have a young councilman in 37 years old. Wow, what, at 37, I was trying to figure out life, and he's rebuilding communities. Lolita.
Hello. I just want to thank everybody for their presence today. And although we've touched on several topics, which I all agree with, I stand here not only as a member of Allegheny Center Alliance Church, but a mother of a young African-American male. And that is something that has not been brought up tonight. And that is something that many of us who are raising children walk around with heavy hearts for. And that cannot be explained for me as a mother who tries very hard to teach her child what to do, how to go about navigating this place. We raise him as a Christian young man, but yet and still, he says, Mom, what do I do? He drives. How can I, and this is not a question, but it's a challenge, and it's something for us to really take heed to. While we are processing from our leadership roles, there's still a reality out here that our children could possibly still be pulled over while driving and they're innocent. There's still police officers out here, and we know there's black-on-black crime, but my challenge to you as panelists, after tonight, how will we move forward? That's the challenge of the night. Will we continue to collaborate and work as one? Because the reality is, as Pastor Rock said, we have to be intentional. And the bottom line is, Christ is the answer. And so without that, there will not be a true movement because we need the Holy Spirit. And that's what our society needs is Jesus Christ. But we need to learn to work together as a whole. So I just challenged that.
There is, thank you. Thank you. Tammy, will you stand up just for a minute? This has been my boss for 13 years. Tammy worked with me in private practice and is the executive assistant, outreach coordinator, diversity coordinator of the U.S. Attorney's Office. She has three wonderful sons. I have four sons. She has to have a different conversation with her sons than I have to have with mine. There is no question. I am responsible, we are responsible to provide you equal justice under the law. That doesn't happen when you have that conversation. Don't give up hope, but don't abandon the community effort and responsibility for this problem. You can sit down. And I will never ask you to do that again. We are working on a lot of projects. We have a new police chief who I have a lot of confidence in, and he's doing a lot of good things. The community work we've been involved in, that Mary Esther's been involved in from the day we started with this premise. We have African-American males around the table, and we do a count of hands. How many times have you been pulled over and released for no reason. It happens. But on the other side of it, we need to teach people how to deal with the current reality till we can get to equal justice under the law. And the law is clear. And the police have the ability to pull people over, and then we have to make sure that these intersections between the police and the community don't end disastrously. We're doing a lot of training that you don't see and hear about. One of the greatest things we did was we brought in two police officers from Kansas City who wrote a book called Policing with Respect. Mm-hmm. Jack and Chip have become pen pals of mine. And they learned what was not, you know, it was an epiphany for them as police officers, that by putting a coffee cup in the police station, inviting the community in, by making that initial gesture of respect, they, as police officers, were safer. And there was a reduction of these terrible events that lead to these bad intersections. So remain faithful, but engage yourself as community members, because you have as much about to do with this outcome, this positive outcome, as we in law enforcement do.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you. Ms. Deer, what is your name?
Ryan.
Chad, help me with the mic there. There we go.
Thank you.
And your name again? I'm sorry.
Ryan.
Hello, Ryan.
So I wanted to ask why social media problems have been, like, it seems like social media has been a big problem at my school and pretty much everywhere I've been, because, like, in my age, we have a lot of social media problems and stuff like that. And I wanted to ask, like, how stereotypes, not only about black people, but about every race, has been funny, and, like, the use of racism and vulgarity about, like, the N-word or stuff like that have been funny to people, but there has been no reports at school or anything like that. And they've been, like, reported. Like, I've had people tell me that there was a site put on Instagram saying we hate black people and we hate white people. So I just want to ask, like, how we can prevent that kind of problem when no one wants to report it and no one can actually see who's behind the screen. So you never know, because it's anonymous. So you never know who's behind the screen of that social media page. So how can you prevent this from happening to you?
Yes.
You know, I firmly believe that that's another challenge in terms of individual thinking and respect for individuals. And we have to get to the point where we understand that everybody deserves to be treated as a human, a dignified human. And in terms of people hiding, why do they do that and hide behind, you know, situations where they don't have to be identified? And those kinds of things stir up the racist notions that are not the case for everyone. It's a few individuals who want to keep that tension, you know, continuing. But the right thing to do is to report it, and hopefully individuals will see that they can at least address it in the best way they can, that and indicate that it's not acceptable. But you're always going to have some individuals who just want to be racist in nature, just because to them it's funny. You know, it's something to do to keep the pot stirred up all the time when it's not necessary.
Now it's anonymous. They can be
anonymous. And they can be anonymous. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah. The Bible also talks, don't overcome evil with evil. Overcome evil with good. So start a I love white people Instagram, yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, really.
How about hashtag love not hate?
Yeah. And I'm not putting, you know, the problem is that there is a problem, but there's also a huge upside that we get to tell our story. If they get to tell their story, we get to tell ours. And we are very hesitant to tell our story because we want to be promoting self or be stepping out of line in a Christian setting, get ahead of the Lord. But I am committed to social media, every aspect I can, to, because Jesus said, what I whisper to you in your room, shout it from the housetops. And I want to encourage you as a young person to shout from the housetops the good things that are happening. and you'll build a constituency, just like those crazy people are building theirs, and they'll build your own, start your own parade, and you can make a difference. And so,
thank you.
Hi there. What is your name?
Hi, my name is Erin.
Hi, Erin.
I'm currently a law student at the University of Pittsburgh.
Hail to Pitt.
And I just want to say thank you, and I'm humbled to be able to listen to people that have struggled with such a complex issue in our society. Before going to law school, I taught elementary school in Charlotte, North Carolina, and my question is, how do you see or have you thought of or heard a discussion about how the growing Hispanic population in America will impact this racialized society discussion that we're having?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to expand it, intensify it, and I don't think you can force people to deal with it, but I think it's going to further leverage people to deal with it. Because our nation is moving to the place where Caucasians will be the minority. And the Hispanic community is, you're hearing rumblings now, and they're only going to intensify. I think it's safe to say that. But it's many of the same principles, played out a bit differently, but many of the same principles. And we either start to, at the micro level, begin to make a difference where we are, or these things will escalate, and rather than having this conversation, we'll also have the Hispanic conversation, and then the Asian American conversation, and another conversation. But we still have to come back to addressing the same issues. Here in Pittsburgh, we're largely a black-white community, 96%. So it's the issue that occupies us here, because that's who we are. But in many other areas, this conversation would be taking place, and it would be Hispanic, Caucasian, or Hispanic and African American. So I think it's only going to intensify the reality of the problem and the necessity of people to quit waiting for somebody else to do something and to do the part they can, which, though it may seem small, I heard years ago, many snowflakes make an avalanche. Snowflakes are infinitesimally small, but you get enough of them together, and they can make a real difference. And I think it's got to spur us to make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Radical. Pastor Sheldon, you helped. Rose, you want to say? Okay, Rose, you were hiding in the bleachers.
I want to make a comment about. I know we teach reading and arithmetic and all of that. But our young people need to have self-esteem. They need to be taught about their characters, how to, we give them awards for athletic achievements and academic achievements. How about giving them awards for character building and treating other people right? Mm-hmm. We need to bring that into our school system.
Yeah, very, very well said, Rose. Thank you. Pastor Sheldon, you have the microphone. Now, give Pastor Sheldon, we want to thank you for helping put the panel right together, Lane. Give Pastor Sheldon any remarks you'd like to make?
No, other than what the panelists have shared with us today. First of all, thank all of you for your response here. It's a Sunday evening, and we had a good response. And as Dr. Stango said, this is one of a few that we're going to do, that we hope to do throughout the year with different type of panelists and different conversations, but somewhat around the same topic. So I just want to thank all of you. I hope that you heard what Pastor Rock said, your takeaways. We want to be challenged, but what do we do from here? It's a conversation. We're supposed to grow us. Hopefully you have big ears, and so that touched you in your heart. Let's do something about it and move forward. So I want to thank the panelists for your responses.
Thank you, Sheldon. Mm-hmm. Thank you for putting this together.
Thank you. Yes, thank you.
Thank all of you.
We've heard tonight about intentionality. We've heard about confronting and challenging our own thinking. We've heard about the sin problem. We've heard about equitable distribution of resources based on need and not just on numbers. We've heard on focusing on sameness. We've heard about media. We've talked about social media. We've talked about a lot of things, and it's been uncomfortable. It's been
good. It's been enriching. But if we don't go and do something as individuals, then it was just, as we heard from several who approached the microphone, it's just been talk. Mm-hmm. And so each one of us can make a difference, and perhaps more important, each one of us needs to make a difference. So we are going to have some refreshments downstairs in Simpson Hall, and we invite our panelists to be a part of that. Please don't corner Councilman Lavelle on when your street is going to be plowed, or, you know, can we come on? Let's keep the conversation meaningful, and because we have great people here with us tonight, we want to take full advantage of them being with us. Pastor Rock, thank you for your hospitality in hosting us tonight. And let's one more time express our appreciation to all the panelists. Now, speaking of social media, we have recorded tonight, and we will be posting this with notice to our blog radio that we have had for almost 4 years now. And I've been all night, as the word has gotten out, people in Dallas and other places have been saying, "Hey, are you streaming it? We would have loved to have listened. We would have loved to be a part of it." For us as the ACAC family, this is part of our expanded influence, and this is a part of what God wants us to do as a people. So thank you for being here tonight. Refreshments downstairs. We'll let you know what's on the radio. Until we're back together again, go make a difference with what you heard tonight. Thank you, and God bless.
All right. Well, there you have it. Great ending. I forgot how good the ending was, and just with the questions and with the comments and the applause and the appreciation. And so that wraps it up. I'm going to go ahead and sign off now. And thanks to you for listening. Please spread the word, and please let people know that this night took place. And hope we did the right thing in putting it in two parts so that it wasn't overwhelming. And so that's about it. This is John Stanko, your host for Ministry Beat. I'm going to go ahead and sign off, get back to work here in Oklahoma City until we're back together again in Pittsburgh. We'll see you around the church campus, and we'll talk to you again next week. So long for now.
Thanks again for listening to this week's edition of Ministry Beat with your host, John Stanko. Join us again next Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the ACAC Internet Radio Network for more interviews and insight into the life of Allegheny Center Alliance Church. You can also access this show by going online to www.blogtalkradio/ACAC Threads. Thank you, and tell your friends about Ministry Beat.